So, whoever would like to answer, ask a question. Yep. You would? Sir? Do we dare raise your finger? Please.
If I understood it correctly, I found that you put a number at a secondary level in comparison to words. You put numbers at a secondary existence compared to words,
yes,
which you said denominated names and certain parts. Where, logically, could we figure the beginning of such a phenomenon when we could trace the priority of one and the secondary existence?
Well, the word priority obviously is in this ambiguous. It can mean two things. One is more dignified than the other, or the other is logically earlier. Of course, numbers and names and words cannot be ascribed to any one moment in time, one earlier and one later, if you mean this by priority. They're probably, according to the Bible, the names are older than the words. If you read the Bible carefully, the men names that gives numbers to the things and their names, that he is called first, and he receives this notion that he is to be called Adam from his maker. So the Bible is quite explicit in distinguishing names and the words for things, you see. The word name, you see, nomen in Latin, is ambiguous in many languages. It may mean a word, a nomen, you see, as in the word nominative in grammar, can just mean word. And there's some ambiguity that in our speaking to each other, the word may mean word or name. And let me make this quite clear. I'll put this here for your better understanding. Of things we speak, to people we speak, and from gods we hear, or we are made to speak. I defined, you see, any power that who makes us speak, who forces me to speak, you see, or to fall silent, that is to change my approach to reality, we call a god. Love makes you speak and sing, you see. It is not the girl who makes you speak, because that you are in love with her, you see. So she has this overpowering influence, and 10 years later she doesn't make you sing, but cry. So it isn't true that she, in her, simply as a person, makes you speak, but the power, you see, of Venus makes her speak, for example, the goddess of love. So if you take three simple words, you will not confuse one and the other. You will also see that we cannot decide what is earlier and what is later. From the gods, we are forced to speak. And we speak to people, and we speak of things. And it's very easy to make this distinction between people and things, you see. Wherever you speak to, you humanize. You can speak to flowers and animals, your tame horse or your tame dog, you speak to. That means you treat it similar to human beings, you see. But on the other hand, you know very well that you can, in general, only speak of dogs and not to dogs. You couldn't have an assembly of dogs and give them a talk, as I try today at this moment, you see.
My problem, Professor, was,
yeah,
when I talk to a certain thing or a certain person, I presuppose
a thing.
When I talk to something other than myself.
Well, you presuppose that it can talk back, don't you? You fear, I have dread that you talk back now to me, you see. So I treat you as a human being. But off this table, I can say that it is brown, you see. But I expect not the table suddenly to get up and contradict me. You may contradict me. It cannot. That's the difference between men and things, isn't it? So, and that's a decisive difference. But in our modern world, we have neglected this. Speech has been degraded to something, you see, about things. And we always forget that the words we use may come back and tell against us, you see. I mean, most people are in safety, especially journalists and professors, you see. They have made sure that nobody can talk back in an examination. They have to answer questions. I think this may really help. You see, from the gods we are inspired and compelled to speak. Any love that is overwhelming, we'll speak of this at the end a little more explicitly. It is very strange that this should have been overlooked all through the 19th century. And as they said, there are no gods. If you think that God is the power who created the world, what do we know about that? The geologists tell us this was 900 million years ago. It's probably not true, but they say so, and we can't contradict them because they use numbers. And we have just, you see, to be silent. And however, from the gods comes this compulsion to speak, and to men we speak, or among men, and we are equals with others in this respect. And you can also now see, follow this, perhaps at a certain moment, I have reserved this for the beginning of tonight, but your question leads to this. In men, the two worlds of speech meet. Here we are, you have a name and I have a name, and we participate in the divine presence, but we use words to each other, you see, and in this way we are in human society. And so in men there is a division. I use words in society, but every one of the men participating claims that he has a name, that he is not to be confused with anybody else, and you insult a man if you insist that he is only a number. In the state of Arkansas, any child born, you know, gets a number. You may know this. I think it's for all the United States, for fingerprinting purposes, isn't it true? That we all are now, they introduced this during the Second World War, isn't this true? Yeah. So, but fortunately we ignore this, you see. Mr. Winter is Mr. Winter, and he's not 0003476. So we find only prisoners are degraded to have numbers. It was a great invention of Mr. Hitler to take away the name of a person in the concentration camps. And they ended up as numbers, you see. And once you make a man into a number, he has ceased really to live. I mean, it is a very fine cruelty to treat prisoners to numbers. So, what number? What else, please?
May one speak to a God, to the gods which have given him voice?
Well, one can respond, one can obey, one can answer. If you think that the gods can be spoken to, I decline to answer this question in such a way, because you haven't committed yourself, Mr. Hirschman, to the question if they talk to you. Before you have not admitted this, it's though you talk, saying that you can talk back to them. Most people today, you see, say there is a God, they are all deists, you see, but they would not acknowledge that the gods talk to them. And so this philosophizing of Mr. Voltaire and family, you see, doesn't interest me. That wouldn't lead anywhere. Of course, I could admit it, sir, but it would be misleading in this audience, because the real mystery of the divine powers is only that they make us speak. As a consequence, we implore them, we invoke them, we may turn away with them, you can deny them, you can... all prayer, you see, is an answer. We acknowledge their power, but this acknowledgement has to come first, and therefore your question cannot be answered in this. You see, it's the second step that we answer. If you are interested, I mean, as you know, most modern men cannot define what prayer is. They say, well, the gods don't listen anyway, so why bother? Prayer is something airy in church from 11 to 12 or from 9:15 to 10, but otherwise it is something for children. Now, I don't think so. I'm very serious in this matter, but it is very hard for me to make myself understood. Most people today think that it is a petrified frail, and it is not something that happens every minute. And this is quite serious. The question, what is to be achieved with prayer? You see, only through prayer does anyone place himself in the universe, because only vis-a-vis and in the face of the gods can you or I know who we are. Nobody of you can tell me who I am, you see. Because it's mostly either flattery or cruelty, hatred or love. It's certainly not the truth. So I invoke the gods in order to learn what a human creature on this earth represents, in general and in my personal case. Take a man rejected by humanity. That's why Christianity, you see, begins with the man who is rejected, you see. The stone whom the masons have rejected, you see, has become the cornerstone, you see, because in his prayer, God alone could tell him the answer, who he was. The men declined to know, declined to recognize. Prayer is something constantly in everybody's mind, whether you sigh or laugh or what. Whenever you have to readjust your true nature in comparison to the flatteries or the vituperation or the insults, you see, or the ignorance of the crowd, you try to recover who you are and who else can direct you in this respect, unless there is a power greater than you in the face of whom you try to pass muster, you see, to be tolerated, to be inserted. Now think, since we are all abominable sinners, this is not so easily done. You know better about your shortcomings than anybody else, or at least you could. We know our shortcomings much more than anybody else, and that's the meaning of this Sunday prayer in church, you see. Abominable sinner, you see, and there's no goodness found in us. But it is not limited to the church. I mean, any honest man knows that most people have too good an opinion of him. Now, to recuperate your sense of balance, you have to have a vis-a-vis. The secret of all speech is that it always takes two people, one who listens and one who speaks. All self-reliance leads into the lunatic asylum. The people who say, I'm the emperor of China, usually end in a straitjacket. And it's very funny that the philosophy of the last 200 years begins with self and ends with self, with the dissolution of self. You see, it's not an accident in the last 20 years this country has introduced into its vocabulary the word schizophrenia, schizoid, you see, etc. And you all take it for granted that most people in this country are schizophrenic. They probably are because they want to be alone. If you pray to God, you will not be schizophrenic, because somebody else will face you and you will face him, and then you can learn who you are. If you try, however, to organize inside yourself this discussion, who am I, will you kindly say to yourself, John, you see, Johnny, will you kindly tell me who I am, you split. You have somebody who is meant to tell you, and most people do this nowadays. So they, of course, they go crazy. And schizophrenia is the American disease, as you know. No country is so overdeveloped in here, because obviously atheism is the most widely spread virtue of this country, and is a practical atheism. I don't mean church going or not church going, that isn't decisive, but prayer. That is the knowledge that you can neither receive from yourself the passport into heaven, nor can you receive it from your fellow men. Their esteem may be based on false assumption, and yours certainly is based on false assumption. And therefore, the clarity only comes to anybody who speaks with somebody else. And for this reason, sir, you see the connection, you see. Prayer is an answer to the position that there are gods. It's not a proposition to the truth that there is one God. That's already a conversion, and a convergence, and a revelation that there's one God. But I speak of all men. You take the Dutch society people who begin with the allegiance to the God. That's all right, it's a partial God, divinity whom they worship. That's very serious. And it's better than nothing. You see, it isn't enough, because it's only one God among many in the nation. It's not the only God. And the research professor who asked for $1 million for his research. I mean, he has science as his God. Why shouldn't he? It's a master. But it is not enough, because he must also be willing to admit that it's sheer nonsense what he does. In one case it is.
Dr. Rosenstock, you made a statement last time, very quickly, but I wondered if you would go and clarify what you meant to me. You said, God is only powerful in the weak.
Have you never realized that? That you, as long as you strut and stand before the mirror with your new dress, you are just human. Obviously, any communication of the divine spirit to others can only come when you give way with your new, put away your new dress and your spring hat and let the word of God pass through you as it's his receptacle. As long as we strut, obviously, there is no God. So God appears only on the scene when we make ourselves very brittle and very frail. I mean, that's why the Christmas child appears in the cradle and on the cross. In both situations, the Lord is perfectly weak, you see. He has no power and no beauty in the sight of men. And the...
You mean you define weak as being no power or no authority? Is
What? You can test it in every one case, it's very easy.
You mean you're not thinking of physical weakness, that's what I thought you were.
Well, the baby in the cradle is probably chosen as it must have for the physical weakness, but then there's moral weakness, and then there is, of course, the no authority, I mean, no security, I mean, that's Jesus on the cross. But all the situations in the life of the Lord are, you see, one of accentuated weakness. It is physical weakness, it is, how would you call the weakness in authority, I mean, the absence of authority. We don't say this so much than the word weak, but St. Paul meant all weakness is inducive, you see, to make visible the glory of the Lord who speaks to us frail receptacles. That's why out of the mouth and babes and sucklings the truth may be told.
But you don't consider Christ weak.
Pardon me?
You don't consider that Christ was weak, do you? In this sense you would, wouldn't you?
Well, if you read kindly the second chapter of Philippians, he declined his divinity and became man in order to through his weakness, to glorify the Father. It's everywhere in the New Testament. It's not, I haven't invented it. It's difficult to understand if you press the word weak, because in the eyes of men you see the inspiration which it makes, gives you power to testify in any one moment to an important truth that otherwise has been neglected. You may feel very powerful because God speaks through you, but in the eyes of the world, you are, who are you, mister? You see, very weak. What is the trouble in this, my answer? You are not satisfied.
I'm thinking of moral weakness. I'm thinking of all types of weakness. And
well, when Lazarus died, Jesus wept. That's certainly very weak in considering to the event and to the demand made on him to resuscitate him. You see, men in our society are so strong they don't weep. They just go to the lunatic asylum instead. You see, if more Americans would weep, they wouldn't have to go to the analyst. Weeping has been abolished in our society because it's a token of weakness. But I assure you that the shedding of tears is a very healthy perception. And if more people would cry, you see, they wouldn't fall prey to the psychiatrist. Too many people in this country shed tears, I assure you. And that is, of course, it is considered a sign of weakness. I assure you it is not. The tears are just as divine, you see, as all love is. Because you only cry in sympathy with somebody else you love. Or some fear you have for the community. This is a very sore point with me in this country, you see. The crying has been abolished. People don't even cry at the cemetery.
You see,
we just the loved ones.
Well,
You have read it, I'm sure.
If you'd say humbleness, then this would not be weakness to me, in the sense that I think of weakness.
Well, it's a quotation. God is, you see, strong in the weak. I have not said it. The Apostle Paul has, unfortunately, has said it. So we have to...
And it was translated from another language. I had the first.
But it is weak. It's us denial. It means powerlessness. If you want to translate it this way, you see that the great truth must come to you not with the police force, you see, but as true, and that makes it powerless. It is the larger and greater and more pronounced your freedom is to reject this truth. The more directly is the truth, you see, to be understood as divine. God doesn't force you. He wants your allegiance. The allegiance must be freely given. If it isn't freely given, you see, it is forced, and you will admit that if the teacher of this truth or the spokesman of this truth can use force and has force behind it, there's little merit in your obeying this, you see. You are only, so to speak, meritorious. You deserve, you see, as our esteem if you do it freely. Therefore, the word has to come you, as it has come to you, outside a power stream, not under the power of be it a police force or the SS of Mr. Hitler or the Commissars or the FBI or some such organization which simply doesn't ask for your consent, but acts, you see, overpowers you. Can't you see the difference?
Yes, sir. I see my interpretation of weak has always been quite different from the way you're applying it in this sense. We are not in disagreement with what you're saying. It's only in the implication of the word that I had.
Well, it is, I can see it. It is not worse than my vocabulary. Perhaps I would have expressed it differently, but it's a quotation. And therefore, I didn't tamper with it. Yeah?
I was a little confused about something, and I'm sure you can straighten me out easily. You said that one of the great importances in language, in words, was the tense, the sense of tense. And I was thinking afterwards that most abstract language, like the language of theology or philosophy or law, quite explicitly is not concerned with tense. And
is not? Do you think it isn't?
I don't know. It's
thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery.
Well, in a conditional sense, but only in the conditional sense, not in the sense of past to present to future.
That's a very important point, and you will allow me to build up the whole lecture today on this question. If you are right, I'm speaking in vain. And since I am right, of course I'm not speaking.
Between a plurality of God and a singular God?
Very good. That's, of course, the deepest secret. Certainly, I do feel, however, let me say this today, and I will not answer the question because it's really the question of the transition from paganism to revelation, from pre-biblical worship of any God of our athletes. Worship, you see, at the altar of sport, and the patriots worship at the altar of the American flag, and so there are many gods among us, but we know a little better, and we feel that these gods should be under God, you see, the singular. And however, the relapse into paganism is so common today, and it seems that so very few people represent the discovery of the unity of our God that I had to stress the fact that the pagans also worship, you see, names, only they don't worship the name of above all names, as the Bible calls it, and so I left it dangling in the air for the time being, because I tried to say something that is valid regardless of the weakness of any one man's creed or belief or theology. It's only to universalize, you see, my remark on the gods, that I wanted to embrace all the Voltaires and Rousseaus just as well. And after all, there are very few Americans who have resisted the modern trend to say, well, it makes no difference, we are all good and we are all nice, we all go to heaven. You see, this universalism is, after all, at this moment, the general religion, you see, of mankind in this country. And it isn't enough. And as a hint, I may tell you already today, the gods of the heathen, you see, are not understood to be the sources of speech. The word, the living word of the Gospel of St. John is a great discovery, that God is the power who speaks. I couldn't have given you the definition of the gods who make us speak before the Gospel of St. John was written. Because in the word, the secret is revealed that through our Maker, we possess this wonderful gift of orienting us by speech. We co-create with him, we can talk to each other about his purposes, you see, his aims, his creatures, and thereby participate in the Divine Spirit. That's what we mean by the Holy Spirit and by the Son and the Father giving us this revelation. So today, it is easy to say that the perfect divinity, of course, must be the source of all human speech. The pagans didn't know this secret. They didn't know that Venus and Ares were only little fragments of this great power of men to speak, and to sing, you see. And so that's the relation of God and the gods. And that's why the Bible is full of this scorn for the gods who are deaf and dumb. See, they can neither listen nor speak. They are only little fragments of the real power. The American flag is quite, you see, obtuse. It does not hear when you dance around it. You see, you may worship this God, but the American flag certainly does nothing of the kind. And so there you have the limitations of any limited gods. But they are, the Hebrew language, as you know, has always distinguished between the Elohim as a name for God and Jehovah. You see, the one God, of course. And it is just as well if I go on from here perhaps now. Is there any other question? And tell you, you see, that the Hebrews, in the first chapters of the Bible, as you know, use this common word Elohim, which simply means all the gods of anywhere rightly worshipped. There are many gods. Youth is such a god, as any old person will tell you. And if he leaves us, it's very painful. Love is such a god, you see. Courage is such a divinity. Sports is science, is government, good government is. And friendship is, certainly. And there are family spirits whom we rightly try to maintain and to worship. And there are gods. And the Bible is full of this word Elohim, you see. And there are also sentences in the Bible, Mr. Rusak will know this, where it just says the gods ruled by the one God. The discovery of the Bible is only that there must be one name which distinguishes the living God from these gods, established deities, you see, like the nation. The word, as you know, is Yahweh, and there's been a great fight over the significance of this name. And people have, as Moses receives his message in the burning bush, he is told that the name means, you do not know where I shall be tomorrow. This is the best translation I can find. You do not know where I shall be tomorrow. Yuru is translated, I shall be whom I shall be. But the meaning is, you see, that you cannot tell where I shall appear tomorrow. And that's the living God. And God always appears where he is most unexpected. And in the weak, you see, in the inconspicuous, in the ugly, you see, in the rejected ones, there you have to dwell the sudden apparition, you see, of the next revelation. That's so exciting about life. You can never be sure that it isn't the President of the United States. He may, in rare cases, be blessed, as he certainly was in Lincoln's case, you see. And the more inconspicuous this Mr. Lincoln appeared to the gentleman from Harvard, you see, the more he was divinely inspired. And after Mr. Everett had spoken for 3 hours, Everett had spoken for 3 hours at Gettysburg, he got up and spoke 10 minutes, and then the paper disappeared in the waste paper basket, you see, and it was the Gettysburg address.
I thought that was strength.
That was weakness. Because Mr. Everett and his clan thought, what a weak man, you see, who remembers a few words and then puts the paper in the waste paper basket. And Mr. Everett had it written all up and was ready for the press. Would you really not see the point?
No,
that
the
weak?
Other
men
thought he was weak, but yes. I thought it was strength in this man.
But that's no contradiction. No. That's no contradiction. Strength in the men and weakness in appearance.
Weakness in
appearance? In appearance.
In appearance.
The public thought, who is this man from Springfield, Illinois? See? He hadn't gone to any highest institution of learning, not even to Yale.
Would the word mean something to you?
It is not, because it is not your own feeling about yourself, mistress humility, but that the world thinks of you as just nobody. That's very different from meekness. You can take this treatment by the world with pride or with haughtiness or with contempt or with meekness. But obviously, whether you are meek or not doesn't change the fact that you appear in the eyes of the world, you see, as a very unimportant person. When Huss was burned at stake, you know, when the old woman brought the faggots to the fire, and he exclaimed, Sancta Simplicitas, O Saint Simplicity, you see. He certainly was weak, but he made the Reformation unavoidable. And 100 years later, coins were coined in Bohemia, and it said, 100 years have elapsed from the burning of Huss, therefore the Reformation is bound to happen now. And it was true, this was in 1515, and 2 years later Luther stood up. And wasn't Huss weak? But God was with him, and he testified that the old order could not go on. I mean, that's very serious. It is weakness and not meekness. You see that meekness is only in your acceptance of your weakness. But the weakness is objectively and truly there.
Weakness is strength.
Can be strength. Mm-hmm. It can become strength. Yeah. It opens up for strength. Oh, yeah. When Jesus said, I mean, sure, there's strength. When Jesus said to the people who made him carry the cross, the Father forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. That is great strength for me, on his part, but certainly appeared the weakest of the weak at this moment in the eyes of to the eyes of the world, isn't that? Who was he to say such a thing? They probably laughed. You can say weakness is, in this sense, is always when other people think they can laugh wantonly without with impunity. That's, I think, a good description of weakness. That when the other people say, it doesn't matter what, if I laugh at this man, nothing will occur. I will not be punished for it. Most blasphemers are of this sort, that they do not see when a divine command or order enters the scene, you see. They laughed on this. Wherever there is such laughter, I have heard too many people blaspheme. And it is even not known what blasphemy means. I mean, the word blasphemy is going out of business. And because it's so rampant that people don't know what they're doing. And that's a sin against the Holy Spirit, and it shall not be forgiven. And I believe it. That's simply true. I once talked about St. Martha under Hitler to a group of very educated people. The lady was the wife of the editor of once the Living Age. Some of you may know that there has been such a magazine in this country. So she certainly was obligated to believe in the living spirit. She didn't. We talked, and her grandchildren were present, and they all were touched to the quick and had tears in their eyes when I talked about these martyrs under Hitler, Catholics and Protestants who suffered for their righteous faith. And the old lady began to chuckle and destroy the whole impression I had made in these children by saying, oh, it won't have been so hot. And she had no reason to say this, but she was able to destroy this bridge that had been built, you see, between the sufferings of these people and the hearts of these innocents. And it was that I call blasphemy. She couldn't stand the solemnity or the rigor, you see, of the situation, that something bigger than she had happened. She was the measure of her own, of greatness. Many people are like that in this country, you see. And probably as the editor of a journal, she was ruined for life. I mean, the printed word, of course, ruins more than the spoken word. It freezes you out. I mean, you become superior in your judgment and more arbiter and more hardboiled. But this is just a little example of the fact that here's a weakness of my story and authority. The people had all died under Hitler's hand. If there was nobody who exalted them in his own heart, you see, to the majesty in heaven which they could claim and can claim, there was nothing doing it. She had, of course, the power as a devil to laugh it off and to chuckle and to say, well, what's all this, you see. So, which she did proceeded to do. Perhaps it proves to you that God is weak, you see, powerful in the weak, but if you decline to believe, and if God doesn't speak to you, it's nothing to do. She was within her, not within her rights, only within her power. And it happens every day in this country. I mean, blasphemy, no minister I've ever heard preaching about blasphemy, they don't dare to tell you that you can commit blasphemy. It's very strange. Probably they commit it themselves. Yeah, it is very serious. You see, there is no believing God if you do not believe that blasphemy is possible. Then I don't care. If you think you can say what you please and think what you please without committing blasphemy, obviously the fact that you say, I go to church or I'm a believer, makes no sense. One is the corollary of the other. If we cannot commit blasphemy, we cannot commit ourselves to the living God. We cannot fall into his hands. And he cannot create us or recreate us either. It is so too simple, I think, to be believed. May I now break off this discussion? Otherwise, we can't follow through. I do feel, pardon me for now claiming a little importance for the main statement of last time, that language has not been given to men for the purpose of saying, this is a chair. It has not been given to us to speak about things and numbers. That is subordinate to the fact that we are made to speak, to be called into an event, to fulfill it, and to leave off and to get out of it free again. All names, invocations, are commands, begin as commands. The first form of any name is the imperative or the vocative. In your grammar books you learn differently. You learn that the word, let's name Tullius Cicero, Tullius is a so-called nominative, you see. The poet, the table, that's the nominative. You have to learn it in French and in German, and when you learn a foreign language, you're plagued with the nominatives, the genitives, the datives. Even you have been, Carter, have you? All right. So, this is perfectly untrue. The Jews, as you know, forbid the use of the word Yahweh and say instead in all the places of the Bible when it is read out loud, the Lord, Kyrie, Adonai, in Hebrew. And people today imagine that's a taboo, as it is called by these modern blasphemers, the so-called anthropologists. And that's of course nonsense. It's the vocative generally can only be used by the high priest when he invokes the mercy of God, you see, by speaking to him in the temple. Yahweh is an invocation, a vocative. And the nominative, dative, genitive, when you speak of him, cannot be the same word because he's omnipresent and he's even there when you speak of him, as though he was absent, you see. Even when a professor of theology talks to his students about the qualifications of the divinity, God happens to listen in, whether the professor knows it or not. He says, mostly does not know it. He thinks he's certainly absent, but he isn't. Now, will you kindly keep this in mind? The taboo or that you should not use this term comes from the fact that you may use this name only in the imperative. The true God, the living God, sir, that is important for you, is the power who only can be spoken to in answer, because he has spoken to us, who must be used in the vocative, who has no other grammatical forms like this chair or like you and I, you see, of whom and to whom we can speak as though they were datives and genitives and accusatives. God cannot be put in the accusative, in other words, which is a very simple. In his majesty, he is the only I in the universe, you see. Martin Buber tells the story of two Jewish men in Poland. One comes at night to the door window of the other and knocks and says, and he's asked, who is there outside? And he says, it's I, Martin. And the man inside says, who dares to say I except God Almighty himself? You see? You understand? The vocative is the only form in which God can be really treated decently. If you cannot speak of him as you can speak of things. We all do. But, and that's how God has lost his fence, so to speak, over our souls. But the people, when we speak of the God, it is wiser to speak of the God, because this is not the living God. So I have some reason to use the plural, you see. Well, otherwise I couldn't treat this in such harmless manner. Mr. Rusak, you may be interested. This is the problem, you see, the vocative against the other cases in grammar. That is the problem of the treatment of the name of Yahweh in the Old Testament. That's why it's to put, so to speak, on ice and cannot be used wantonly, you see, in the other forms. Not even in the nominative, not even the Lord. You see, you can only say, O Lord, but you cannot say the Lord, because the Lord may be spoken of in his absence. That's impossible. It's a contradiction in terms. The only way of speaking of him is to speak to him and in his face. And what I do here is can only be forgiven as an instruction, a preliminary measure to lead you where this is no longer necessary. What I was trying to say is that all speech begins with an invocation. I must hear myself called. Then I begin to operate, I begin to move. So all speech is provocative. Evocative is perhaps the old word, you see. When in Rome war was declared, they had a special college of priests and feeling that war was a terrible thing, just as modern pacifists, the Romans, this belligerent nation, felt just as pacifists feel today, that it was an ugly thing to do. So they called first on the gods of the neighboring city against whom they were going to war, and invited them to leave their city and come over to Rome. They evoked the gods. It may sound to you primitive. I think it's a very pious gesture. They felt they could not make war against the city in which the gods still were alive. So they asked them, come over to us. The Fetiales, the priests of the College of the Fetiales, had to do this. And after they had evoked the gods from the other side, they felt free then to wage war against humans. You see, they didn't want to make war against the gods. I think it would help if we felt the same way, you see, that we do not wage war against their gods, but only against them as mortals and men. And that's the issue today again, of course, among us, to make us feel, you see, that we cannot make war in as far as these other nations have also inherited part of the divine spirit. If you understand that all language begins with an imperative, with an order to which you have to give obedience, that you are moved, then you understand that the secret of language is to go through this movement. For example, come, I'm coming, we have come, gone, it's over with. Language is a drama acted upon any action that can be taken in human life, and we are always involved in such a process that we halt at any one moment in the midst of such an evolution from imperative to analysis. So the analytical sentence, this has been done, consummatum, as the Lord said on the cross when it was all over. And he's the only man who was empowered to look back at his own act and to say, it is done. But we all are involved in small things. Read, I'm reading, you see, I have read. The Hindus have a very beautiful story about the right order of things. They say, when a father says to his children, break wood in the forest and bring it to me, what is the correct answer? And the grammarian Panini has stated that the correct answer would be that the children first go out singing, we are going into the woods, breaking the wood for our father, that they must not say anything to their father before they have been gone and returned, and then they must say, Father, the wood is broken. That's the right answer to the command, break the wood. In this country, you see, or in the New Testament, the Lord mentions the same type of school child, you see, you tell them, go and do this, and the child says yes and does nothing. That is, in our language today, we have lost the time sense. We have lost this miraculous fact that any one verb wants to be conjugated through all its tenses before this word leaves us uninvolved and free. We are free then from this one obligation. Any one human being says and one did it. Let's take this modern scientist who has to say one day, I'm going to be a scientist, I feel that is my mission. He's under the imperatives. God seems to tell him, become a scientist. As long as he hears this, this is a long stage. He has to prepare his parents for this fatal step and himself, and his fiancée, of course, he has to support him many years. And then he sings in his fear, of course, of this great task, I'm going to be a scientist, you see. I'm going to be a scientist. And he whistles in the dark. And finally he can say, I am in research, you see. I am in research. And he begins to sing. And that is the attitude of being involved in something in the present. The command points, become a scientist, that's the future. The song, I am in science, you see, I am in research, as they all try to say now, sing now, I am in research, that's the so-called, what you call the present tense, which is a very complicated thing. And then the people give him the Nobel Prize for the research he has done. And then in the history of science, he occupies the place and his role is analyzed finally, you see, and people look back on this man, Mr. Faraday or Mr. Einstein or whoever it is, and say, this has been achieved in his days, you see, and now we are up to other things. We analyze him away. Analysis, in retrospect, tries to freeze away for new tasks. You go to the analyst to get out of your thicket and begin a new life. So we have four tenses or four orders of speech for any one verb, and the meaning of our language is not that I can say this is the chair and you are Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so, but the meaning of speech is that any one act can be looked upon before I get at it. It is in front of me in the future. I go through with it. I'm in it. I'm allowed to state that I have done my part. I'm allowed to get out of it. And finally, other people, third people, can look upon it as having been done by me. And now then it can be criticized, and that's what happens to the poet by the modern multitude of so-called literary critics. And today you all, ladies and gentlemen, act and treat language in the opposite sequence, and that's why we live in a dead country. What's death? When you begin with analysis, and then I try to deduct from analysis what you should do. Nobody can ever know from analysis what you should do tomorrow. At the end of life and not the beginning. But in this country, you see, you think seeing is believing. It isn't. Yeah, not even in Missouri. There's a deep illness today in the world. It's a complete relapse into paganism, because you treat speech as though it began with numbers. There are 3 billion people on the world. There's a population explosion. Therefore, you have to use artificial means for prohibiting new births. See, swine who go around and proclaim that because there's a population explosion, children must not be born. Try to deduce from the analysis of figures the commands of the living God. It's just incredible. Decent ladies do this. And perhaps some of you are members of this society too. And I'm not. Because that's the most personal manner. Every one couple of people may decide or may not decide, but certainly you cannot generalize this. That's the end of the world if you do. That's everybody's unique decision how he should lead his life with his spouse. It's very serious, I think. I know a lady in Chicago, one of the richest ladies of this country, a very nice lady, by the way, and she has innumerable millions of dollars. That's now going into the billions, as you know. If you want to be decent in this country, you cannot be a millionaire, you have to be a billionaire. She is. And she also has a house in California. And she is, of course, a prominent member of this birth control society for the Japanese. She has 4 children, but the Japanese must not. It is fantastic, but it is true. But it's not her fault. In this country, you see, you may confuse the senses. All commands, when you are calling your name, place you in a new situation. Gropingly, you run somewhere, and you scent perhaps, you flare, you have a flare for the hunch where God is turning to. Old rush. That's the scent for the new direction of life. It is not the eye that redirects humanity. It is the nose. And just as we carry over from the eyesight the word inside, so you must understand that from our scent and flair and our sense of odor and our sense of smell, we also smell the future. The English have for a long time known this, and they are very fine chemists who have, yes, chemists, you wouldn't be supposed to believe it, my dear Baldwin, chemists who have followed out the meaning of smell.
And they say smell connects men with the future.
If you run where there is a good smell, you see, because there's life. The flower, you see, flower gives off this wonderful odor. And a very learned chemist in Germany, the grandson of Mr. Virchow, what's his name now? I've used the word book so often. Now it comes, it just escapes me, and will come back to me, his name. Already 40 years ago, proved that there were only six forms of smell. Three towards death and three towards life. You wouldn't believe it. No. And flowery, fruity, spicy, that's life, you see. And burning and burned and foul. And one more, ogu, how would you call it? The ogu of deer, or ogu in French. And it's just at the verge of turning from freshness to
holy.
Yeah, well, that's this part, this color. There are only these six classes of smells, and they are degrees of vitality, degrees of futurity, or degrees of passé. Burned means it's over with. No, nothing can go there anymore. Well, I mean to say, the imperative has in its translation into action the power to attract us into a new realm where we haven't moved before. It involves us. And that is meant by hunch. You see, government by hunch. Mr. Kepler, who spent, this may impress you, he is in my authority, who spent in 10 years $74 million for the Carnegie Foundation, always said, I give it by hunches. I have no time. $74 million to be given away in 10 years, that's very difficult, you know. And he said, I cannot read questionnaires and memoranda, you see. I must follow my hunches. And he managed to get rid of the money in 10 years. And very wisely so. You may have heard his name, Kepler. And I'm very serious. Where there is, a man has a nose, he can go into politics. We have a minister in Germany who is very famous for his economy, Mr. Erhard. He has not the slightest nose. No sense of, you see, of sense, no flair. So we all hope over there that he will not become the successor to Mr. Adenauer. But the bankers don't know that they have no nose, and so they think he's wonderful. He has no statistics. All on his fingertips, you see. He sees the world. That's the way, is it? He who sees the world is perfectly inadequate for governing it or for leading it. Leadership doesn't come from either. And the curse of this country is, of course, life and all the other magazines put together. I mean, the photographs are still life, you see. That's life, still life. Still born life. It's very dangerous. This country is in great danger because it tries to know the future from seeing it. And that's impossible, that's forbidden. The sequence is odor first, hearing and obedience second. Touch and contact third, and eyesight last. I will now put this on the blackboard. Because I'm the writer, you have to leave. Anybody who has approached language with reverence as a religious fact and not as a fact of acoustics or the fact of children's free art, but as a serious business, as our privilege that we are allowed to speak.
who have taken this series have discovered that the meaning of speaking is to place us in time and space. This, the Kantians, the philosophers, as you know, for 150 years have poked fun at this limitation that we only, that there is time and space. The divine brain, of course, was declared superior to time and space, and the truth about the bomb can be known at any time and any space. Mathematicians assure you that they think outside time and space, except for their own promotion. And then, nobody can live one moment outside time and space. He needs a name even to be tolerated and not executed when he's born. The child has to receive a name, because otherwise anybody can kill it and say it's not a human being. So speech is the protection of around our human existence, and therefore it is our divinity. It is nothing technical. And you have today, every one of you has to decide whether he's on the side of the devils or of the angels. The devils say speech are tools. Language is a tool. Most books I read, I open and I know, not, I can learn, can't learn anything from them because they believe it. Language is a tool. And then, you see, they are suddenly very much surprised that they are treated as Americans or as Japanese just because they speak a certain language and have tremendous religious and political consequences, whatever you say or whatever people say of you. And they are quite confused, because in fact we all live by words and by the names set to us in our absence or to our face, you see. And only to show you the involvement of that, simply I would like to put this on. Wherever something new strikes you, where, for example, a politician says there's something foul in the, that's rotten in the state of Dane, and moves in this direction, he is led by his sense or by his flair. And that's, I put the word flair, I put, use the word scent, and you can think of all the nice Parisian scents that you could buy at all the airport in Paris without perfume. And it is this what moves men. Whenever a man takes a new direction in politics, for example, he must have a hunch, you see, like in the Estes case for Mr. Wilson, that there's something to be gotten out of. The second thing is, as this man in research, he said, he's whistled in the dark, and he says, I am in research. There's this beautiful English ballad, you may know it. There is a ship and it sails, she sails the sea, and the sea is deep can be, but not as deep as the love I am in. I know not if I sink or swim. Now this I am in is the best definition of the second step, you see, for anybody who has obeyed a temptation or summons or an exhortation, you see, or duty, whatever it is, the second step is, I'm in, for, you see, for better or for worse. And that's why I quoted, because I haven't found in any other connection this simple word, I am not so deep as the love I am in. This I like very much. But you, as I said, you can also say, I am in research, I am in learning. This being inside is expressed in our language by a special form, I'm going. The ing, which you hang on to the imperative, go, is the answer of the man who has obeyed the order, you see, and says, I'm going. He's in it. Has been drawn into it by this command. Now, all religion begins with commands. There is no religion by theology. Again, this is the curse of modern times, that people believe today when they say theology, they mean religion. That means irreligion. Theology is after the event, when you look over religion and describe it and analyze it and systematize it. Most theologians whom I know now, I will not be impolite. But this has nothing to do with faith. Faith is when you obey an order, you see. Religion is when you are already accustomed to do so, it's a routine. Theology is when you look back and said, I don't understand why my grandfather was so superstitious.
now this country dies now by confusing theology and religion, and religion and faith. Religion is nothing but crystallized faith, and theology is looking back on religion and makes the best of it, or the worst. This is quite serious. I am in, it's the second station. This is the third. The third station is when Mr. Lindbergh returned from Europe, he wrote a book and he called it We. And all looking back is we, never I. He was asked why he called it this way, and he said, I had to include my plane at least. I was went alone, but the plane was with me, and it represented all the workmanship of the United States. So I called it We. The plane went with me, and I went on in the plane. It's a very beautiful story. And I think it was Mr. Hoover who welcomed him back, isn't that so? Yes, Hoover. And he mentioned this in his welcome to Lindbergh, that this was Lindbergh's humanity, that he said we. And it is. The various persons of the grammar, I and you and we, are not at all lifeless figures of a grammar book. They belong to the various forms of aki. What's called us by our name and these and thou, as a Quaker thing he does. And if you call thou and God thou in your prayers, it is obviously that he will not say you to you. It's very strange, of course, it's very strange in the English language that the thee has disappeared for men. But you still say, fortunately, poor me. And that's better than to say I. The proper form for humanity is to call one to us we, me, and not us. That is the true form in which we find ourselves, that somebody is hammering on us, do this. You see, and we answer, poor me, we'll have now to go to the market instead of the what? It is poor, the poor state of affairs for any such verb that you tell the story, once upon a time there were people who, you see, and to speak of them as a third person, and the place for the of the right words, the best words for the analysis is it and they. You see? That is objectifying. Now in America everybody begins with objectivity, as you know. Never is, but he says so. And objective relativity has become the plague of this country. Because you can only be objective when you're outside of the thing. To begin in this way is not possible. You can, we'll never get volunteers who are objective. A man who has to enlist in the Marines cannot act objective. He must do the opposite. He must obey orders. And he must long for getting into orders. He must have a hunch that there his honor, his personality, his whole, his heart will grow. And so, the sequence of speech is always from verb to verb, from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. This is in the event, this is before the event, this is after the event, and this is from the outside when the men who have done it are dead. Or outside of it, you see. Or I feel this is over with. Like Mr. Rodyard now in Martinez, California, the man who built the towers in Watts, you see, he now no longer says, I've done this, he doesn't want you to speak about it. It's objectified, it's outside of it. And that's a tragedy. It shouldn't. I was privileged yesterday to see the tower, so I quite filled with the impression that this is a great thing. Could you for one moment see the result of this little analysis of living speech? We constantly halt and pause at a certain state of action. We are either in the fourth or in the second or in the third or in the fourth act. It's a drama. Whatever we say, whether we go to bed or whether we get up or whether we eat or whether we write or whether we are in love or whether we vote, It's before the event that we have to be attracted to, that the event may take place, may eventuate, you see. And we eventually, we see, when something is not yet, you see, quite certain that it might become an event. But the event spreads out its wings over our life for quite a certain time, in certain things like marriage and profession and political conviction and religious conviction, we get still involved all our lives. And he who has received the name in the cradle can only depose his name and be analyzed when he is buried. And the whole meaning of a name, we talked about this last time, you remember, at the end, I said, the blasphemy of modern naming is in this fact that a name is something of a moment. But a name is something, is an assignment for a whole life. It's an imperative. My whole discovery of the reality of speech began in 1912 when I wrote in my first book that proper names affect its bearer as an imperative. And this was considered unscientific, and the faculty which commissioned me with my first professorship said if I had to omit this from the 200 copies I had to hand over to them of this book. Well, I did omit it in these 200 copies, but it was printed in all the other copies. And I think still this is an important discovery, that names are imperative. They are commands. And if and as long as men take their names as honorable orders of enlistment, enlisting in God's army on earth, you see, men knows what he is there for. And otherwise, if his name has not this power, he is cursed. He is the most unfortunate being among men. All this is denied today. The men, you see, who think he begins with theory and he begins with analysis to live and forms will and order and direction after he has looked at things, totally reverses the order of the universe. In the universe, the little flower you see in the spring attracts you by its smell, and foulness, its stench, makes you flee this part of the world where there's something rotten, and it shouldn't. And just as we use the word inside in a metaphoric sense from side, and know that inside is something that takes place not only on the things visible with the physical eye, you see, but to be seen with an inner understanding, so it is, of course, with smell and scent, metaphorically, the whole world consists in dying and growing substances. Every minute something comes to the fore and has to be, you see, thought out as the promise of the future, and other things are rotten as can be and have to be put on the city dump. And has to be any one moment the metabolism in us demands this decision. Certain things are dying and must be eliminated, and other things must be helped to come to life. And they are inconspicuous. The important thing that has to do with God is powerful in the weak. The beginning of any seed, you see, of futurity, of a promise, is inconspicuous. And I think that's the deepest reason why St. Paul says God is powerful in the weak, you see. Because inconspicuous is a form of weakness, you see. It can be like this woman, where I have sort of elicited in her natural and some deep feeling, she extinguishes, you see. And this extinction is possible in the beginning of any new seed. How many germs have been extinguished by horses, you see, because they were not given time to gain weight and the protective coloring and all the shields of defense which in the process of living we develop. You see, the first is the weakest. Therefore, God is where the creation begins, something new. And the newest is always the feeblest, you see, the least visible. And this is so terrible because we try to discover, as you know, all new things before they are seen, visible, before they can be seen. You want to see God, as in these religious movies, for the abolition of all religion, and so on. The really divine cannot be seen. It can be scented, you can have a flare, and it can be obeyed. It's a very fine book written by an English lord on St. John, and says, every religious act begins with a command. And I heartily agree that in this country it begins with a theory, and nothing begins. Children are not born by instinct. It's against all visible that the new thing starts, you see. Against that what is visible, against the powers, you see, that be, against the skyscrapers, the newness takes its way. So, language is not a dictionary. You found in dictionaries. In the dictionary, the frozen out words appear. Language is only there where the verbal process engulfs me in such a way that I know not if I think or swim, because so deep is the love I am in. We all can only live with some love, some involvement in any one moment. If you go home, it isn't that you are separate from the rest, but there is an involvement which carries you through. Some love, some affection, some hatred, some fear, some greed, some pride. Any moment, there are innumerable numbers of commands pressing on us, you see, and are fulfilled. And if you ask yourself, where do you stand, you will find, and that is now step two I would like to take still today, I will not plague you very long, but a little bit I would like to say, not only that every action which can come to man is only with you and understood by you if you follow it through from obedience to analysis and not in the wrong direction. If you honor our senses in such a way that you begin with the invisible and then let it incarnate and become visible. It is also a good lesson in what it means to understand. The word understanding today is a poor second against this word theory and against the word insight and against this whole creed of seeing is believing. Make it visible. Put it in a picture, photograph it, illustrate it. Understanding obviously literally means to stand under. Under great pressure, under the pressure of some command that waits to be fulfilled, and you know very well if you back out, it will not be fulfilled. One man has to do it. I always like the story of the man who was a commissioner in Germany in the inflation, who was appointed to eliminate all superfluous offices, and his last action was to abolish his own office. That's a good man, you see. He blew himself up in the last analysis. It is this recklessness of our devotion, be it to duty or to beauty, which makes men vital, makes men alive, and then he understands that if understanding is not to be had unless we carry through the act through its various stages. Now, this has tremendous consequences. If understanding means to absolve oneself from this involvement by these four steps of following the scent, obeying the command, narrating the result, and the community which has been founded in the process, the we that you found necessary, you see, to form in order to pull it through, because nobody can act alone. Everybody needs, in the process of such an obedience, to join the Marines or to join a group of scientists or to, you see, I cannot speak here without your kindly coming here. We form in this moment a we, you see, just because I have obeyed the invitation, you see, and I need you, but you, I hope you need me too, to follow through. So all mankind is in this constant process from me to we to it. This coming to life and of one action, and then the oriented thing is over with. I go on to the next. Because we must die to our former actions. We cannot just stay and look back and say, I did this once. It doesn't help an older man. He has to go on doing something. And if this is the full understanding, a dramatic march through the various forms of my own being, then you will understand that our thoughts, the senses which our Maitre has given us, may represent these four stages. What are the senses? I have already mentioned them. To smell, to see, I have mentioned. To touch would be number another sense, and to hear is the fourth sense. The sequence of these senses, I think, is smell, hearing, touch or contact, and seeing. Seeing is the most distancing one. When we see, we look back, it's done. We get out of it. You can only see something outside your own sight. You look at a picture, it's even in a frame, because this is hanging in a second space. Your space and this space are clearly two spaces. They are separated. That's the meaning of a frame. As long as you, these brick walls, they are much more part of us than this picture. This picture is detached. Now, the eye sees only, as you know, at a certain distance. If I put my hand here before my eye, I see nothing. It has to be there, outside of me. So all eyes, the eye estranges objects. And what you call objectivity means that the thing is rather remote, that you can distinguish between you and the object seen. This is very different than a man says, I'm a researcher over my ears. You see, he can't see anything. He is himself in this business. He's in the dark, even. He's in doubt. He's tormented. He is basking perhaps one moment in the glory of the discovery, and the next he is visited by doubts. He is in an ocean wave, up and down, tossed around, that certainly he cannot see. If he tries to see at this moment, he will make no important discovery. It's physical, how he may observe a little machine, but he must be in this research over his ears. Now, all this is today poked fun at. People may know that a man in research is a little crazy, but they do not worship or they do not revere this craziness which he has to go through in order to make any important discovery. But it's the same with something, with anything a housewife does in preparing a feast. I mean, there is at this moment no objectivity, but there's devotion or obedience. And the word obedience, you see, and hearing in a strange manner, unfortunately separated in the English language, which has divided the spiritual and the physical in every respect. It's a great curse. In other languages, obedience and hearing is just the same word, you see. And hearken, Israel, there you have still in the Ten Commandments some identity between hearing and obeying. It is the same thing. He who listens really, you see, obeys. And it's a serious question. The disobedience of man has, of course, produced this wonderful result that he can hear without obeying. We only hear in order to obey. If you, however, now see what happens physically to the man who hears and to the man who sees, in hearing, you are inside the musical or tonal world, which gives off sound. The funny thing is, when you are in a concert or when you are singing yourself, the waves are around you and you are inside of it. It's the opposite from a painting, the painter situation. The painter has to hold the painting away from him, and you as a contemplating animal certainly stand at a distance, otherwise you can't see it. You even have to find the right distance for every one modern painting. It can be quite far away. The opposite is true. The opposite is true of the musical event.
if you analyze it carefully, the flood of waves goes through you, and you bark the inside of it, and it's a very strange fact that it is an inner cosmic situation in which you find yourself. The world is not divided there in two spaces, the world of this picture and your own world, but it is unified. It is one world full of sound, and the sound enters you and leaves you, and you, in hearing, we coalesce with the event. That's perhaps the best expression. You know, we commit this crime today because everybody starts with the eye that our children are forbidden to lip read. They must lip read. It's a scandal that in this country it is allowed to kill the life of a child by asking him to read. I read, or how do you call this? Right.
Sight
reading. It's scandalous. Speech is living speech and has to be joined. And lip reading is the proper. I lip read. I read very fast, I can assure you. And but I, to this day, lip read. That's why I have kept my reason. A person who I reads must go insane. He treats the read things not as something to be heard and to be obeyed and to be consumed and to be digested, but as something to be looked at. You will earn harvest the fruits of Spartacus where you see other people martyred. Martyrs are not to be seen. It's a scandal that this film can be shot in Hollywood. And it will have consequences. In 30 years, the people, the mob, will demand bloody sacrifices and bloody games, you see. It will not be enough that people die in boxing and wrestling. They'll have to die in their fight against animals and tigers. You conjure this up by your own practice of making everything visible. It's forbidden. You can't do this. If you would hear the cries of the victims inside of you in a musical symphony, that wouldn't happen. I mean, this is the inside approach, and that's also the outside approach. So we have learned something. Every act of mankind has to go through four stages. It ends on the outside. Then it can be put away and forgotten and buried. It has to enter our inside, and we feel that we are inside the universe when we are in love or when we are in research. We are part of some greater process which carries us away. As we say, the language is very eloquent, it carries us away. And when we can speak of the community, we have to join in order to carry anything. This flood which carries us away carries us to a shore in which other people do the same thing. We have to find friends, we have to find helpers. So the community speaks in what we call the epics of the story, the narrative. That's another form. And the sense which the art which best represents this seeing clearly where we have come out and how it has all come about is strangely enough in words of history, but in the sensuous world is architecture. If you look at the state house, that is organized movement, already know, or the courthouse or anything, the railroad station, the highway, here this room. We are here the heirs of history. Proven forms of movement to each other and from each other. How we go in, you see how we leave. This is very simple. All this has to be tried out. As you know, it was not so simple to construe even the seating in this room. Only experience of the first time taught us that there should be nobody seated there and nobody there. Now we know. So the outcome today is that we have learned the architecture of such a meeting, how to do it. So it will surprise you, but just as in politics are the largest expression of the hench and the flair with which the grouping of political parties is a program, they cope with the future of California, of the United States, or of the nations at large. So architecture is that remnant of past experience where we know how people should move cooperatively and in unity. Whether it's the organization of a factory or a railroad or a highway, all always there's built in experience of groups who have moved in this way without hurting each other. We only repeat those buildings where we do not perish in the flames or in the too weak a construction. And it's very strange that this high character of architecture is not even welcome today to the architects. They have lost sight of, in a strange manner, that they're building on past experience, on organized movements that already have been tested. But that's the only thing they have to go by. They must know if people in this way take the corridors, the halls of the Pentagon, you know, to get lost in this building. I think it's an anti-architectural undertaking. People had no experience how so many people should cooperate only with paperwork in a building. They tell the story of the captain, or the colonel, I beg your pardon, who went down to the restrooms in the Pentagon and with his typewriter and put a table up there in the entrance of the, you know the story of the restrooms, and sat down and began to type, and they asked him why he was sitting there in this part of the building. He said, because it's the only place where the people know what they're doing. So that is the consequence of wrong architecture. It stifles movement. Our four senses then assign us to different stations of our way through life. That's very important. If you look up the dictionary about the senses, the five senses, it says that these are communications to the brain with which the outer world sends its messages. Nothing could be further from the truth. The five senses are split to the bottom. They give us contradictory messages. When you hear something, the melody of a nightingale, you suddenly don't know how the nightingale looks, and you cannot at the same time listen to the nightingale and look at her. She would run away, fly away, I assure you. The funny idea of the monistic century, of the liberal century, of the 19th century, in other terms of the French Revolution, of the Enlightenment, is that man is simply an observer, and there's a word for the asking. And so there is this tremendous abstraction, as though man existed here as an intelligent being, and there was the world of our maker, or without a maker, you see, and we look at it, we stare at it, we exploit it, we buy it, we sell it, and that's all our relation to the universe. Any verb, from love to write, to dig, to travel, refutes this, because you cannot commit any of these acts without commitment to this good earth and to your neighbors. You have to get involved. That's why people now speak in literature, Mr. Hirschman, of involvement, you see. That's the slogan today. And schizophrenia is a result of this desperate attempt of the scientists and the monists to say that all these four senses are simultaneous at our disposal. Simultaneously. They are not. One after the other, lady, you see. If you do not wish to follow your flair, you will never discover who your proper husband should be, if you wait and sit down until you see him. Seeing is not believing. That's very serious. You have to combat this slogan. It's considered a joke, but I think the American manhood is ruined by this idea that seeing is believing. It is not believing. You cannot see and believe, and you cannot believe and see. It's divided. At different times of life, a young man who doesn't believe cannot become anything important. If he wants to see, as they do now in Dartmouth College, they come to the seniors and bribe them, you see, to join this company or this company. The only thing they can make them see is the salary and the pension plan. And that's what they can see. So I have asked one young man, are you going to join and to follow this corruption? And he said, yes. And I said, what are you going to do between now and the moment you will retire? He said, I don't care. I can retire at 55. That's all important. So the poor man preferred, you see, a visible misery at the end of his life to an invisible life. He will never have any life. And most of these young are today, they inherit the heresies of their grandparents who have seen, said that the world is visible. God's world is not visible. Men's world at the end is visible when the roads are littered with toilet paper. I mean, our world, of course, we make it visible, but that's the end of the world always, you see. Then the world must start again invisibly. Well, that may be too abstract a lesson, but I mean to say that's the important rediscovery. We are involved, our four senses promote us from one state to another. The four senses can only be, I'm only speaking of the four, I could also speak of taste, or in this moment perhaps maybe forgive me if I omit it, smell, eye, ear, and touch. Carry men into four quite different vital situations. Where you use your touch, you can move already. You inherit the earth because there are roads, there are passes. You see, there are hallways, there are staircases. All this is history which you inherit. You enter upon a process that has already formulated. Then you follow your hunches and you go, you see, that's quite different. You are in the unknown. You are the first. You may not know, others may have done it, but you don't care. You don't follow other people's path here, but you blaze the trail. And the trailblazer must follow his here. It's very hard to describe. I wish, we live in a very dangerous world. I have to rediscover this by words, because your children will not be able to go into any land which has not been charted. I am the last American, I think, who has been able still to climb a mountain that had no name, that was not on the map, and give it a name and be found acceptable by the geographical authorities. And I'm very proud of this. And it's gone. There's no white spot on the map that is visible simile of the good life, that as young people we enter the unknown, you see, and follow our hunches faithfully, can no longer be the parallel in the physical world, can no longer be handed over to the young. It's all too well known, and I don't know what's going to happen. That's probably this yearning for the space travel, you see, that they try to find something that is not yet traced and is not yet, you see, projected to the eye sense. But I'm afraid the next time Mr. Carpenter goes up, a photographer of life will accompany him. It's more serious than you think. I think we cease to be able to found communities, as we are already now, when we begin by eyesight. The person next door doesn't look nice enough to join a community. Religion can join a community that is a common obedience to a common command, as of this whole country has been settled by religious communities at first, you see. Because that's the only way. What they saw was horrifying. It was deterring. They looked poorly. They were in rags. They froze. They had red noses and blue ears. And they certainly were an ugly bunch in this distress, you see. But that one doesn't matter. They are children for anything. I mean, this man is pestiferous. And he corrupt anything. Any order of society that is filled only by people who want to be shown cannot stand for one moment, but because they cannot tolerate, you see, anything that is not perfect. Now, we are very imperfect indeed. The first thing we have to learn is that in the meantime, as we say, you see, we look mean. I think the time is up. I'm not satisfied with what I've done today because I have not carried the thing far enough. I'll try my best next time.